Going Linux, episode 122, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice and will help you in going Linux. Today's episode is listener feedback. We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. And in today's episode, there is no Tom. Tom is having computer trouble, self-inflicted again. And I'm sure in our next episode, we'll all be hearing about his issues. So it's a solo episode today. And this episode of Going Linux is brought to you by Audible.com. Right now, to receive the books, you'll need to use Audible's proprietary player in Windows, Windows in a Virtual Machine, or Wine, since they don't yet have a player that runs natively under Linux. If you have one of those options available to you, then we have a special URL that lets you sign up for a free audiobook and a 14-day free trial. If you can't or won't run Windows or the proprietary audio player, we'd like you to sign up for your free trial anyway, and then contact Audible at audible.custhelp.com. That's audible.custhelp.com to let them know that you want a Linux player so that you can listen to their content. If you are an open source software developer, we'd love it if you would contact Audible at greatideas@audible.com and help them in their efforts to develop a player for Linux. The place to go to get our special offer from Audible is audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. There you'll get a free audiobook and a 14-day trial by signing up. And the website again is audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux, and going Linux is all one word. Well, for those of you following my trials and tribulations with the coupon printing saga from Target stores, I did hear back from Target stores, and I received this email, and most of you are going to know exactly what the content of this email is. Dear Larry Bushy, we've taken these comments very seriously, so thanks for taking the time to share your comments about printing coupons from Target.com. I'm sorry for any inconvenience. I've documented your thoughts and comments, which will be shared with the appropriate team. Yes, that was a mistake that was in the email. With the appropriate team for further review. It's just one way we keep working to provide you with the experiences you've come to expect at Target. Hearing about your experience is important to us. Sincerely, Benjamin, Target Guest Relations. And that's it. No contact information. Well, I shouldn't say no contact information. There was a phone number. I have not called it. I'm waiting for them to respond even further. It's been almost a month since I sent them the original communication, and this and one other email worded very similarly are the only two that I have received, and I received them a day or two after sending them the original email about the fact that their proprietary coupon printing software does not run in Linux. Anyway, moving right along, Jonathan Nato has provided us with a promo for the first Northeast Linux Expo. Let's play that now.
Welcome to Worcester. $1.25, please.
Hey, it's Towbooth Willie. Haven't seen you in a long time. How's it going, man?
Good. Thanks for asking, pup.
Hey, Willie, the last time I talked to you, said you were installing Fedora on your computer. How's that working out for you?
Hey, can't complain, pal. How's by you?
Oh, it's going good. Dude, I just installed Debian. It is wicked fast and stable.
So where you headed?
Oh, I'm going to the Northeast GNU Linux Fest.
By the way, what is this for?
Well, it's a conference for all GNU Linux users and open source software. This is going to be a keynote speaker. His name is Matt Lee. He's from the Free Software Foundation. He's going to be speaking on free software. And there's also going to be exhibitors there from like GNOME, KDE, and other open source projects where you can talk to them about the various things that they're doing within the project. And it's just going to be a great place to hang out with other GNU Linux users and geek out. Oh, by the way, Willie, the conference is at Worcester State University at 486 Chandler Street. Do you know how to get there?
Well, I know my way around New England, I can tell you that much.
Well, I guess I can just check out the directions on northeastlinuxfest.org. I know they have them there.
Okay, sure.
Oh, hey, Willie, how much is it for the toll?
The state charges $1.25, pal.
Man, $1.25? That's more than my operating system costs. Well, here you go.
Would you like a receipt with that?
Yeah, sure, I'll take one. Thanks.
And here you are.
Well, we'll see you later, Willie. Have a good day.
Hey, hey!
Oh, what? Willie, you want to come with us to the GNU Linux Fest? Come on, man, get out of there. Hop in the car. We'll take off and go and have a great time.
I'm coming out of the booth!
That's right, so if you want to join us and Towbooth Willie at the Northeast GNU Linux Fest, it's going to be in Worcester, Massachusetts, at Worcester State University, located at 486 Chandler Street in the Student Center. It's going to be on April 2nd, starting at 10:30 a.m., going until 3 p.m. There's also going to be an after party at Jillian's, so come on down and have a great time. Visit us at northeastlinuxfest.org, and please, if you plan on coming, register so that way we know who to expect and who's coming. Again, visit us at the website, northeastlinuxfest.org. We hope to see you soon.
All right, and we've received some voicemail on our voicemail line. The first one is from Martin in Austria.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Tom. This is Martin Wildam from Vienna in Austria. Thank you very much for your last episode regarding the remote assistant software. I used quite all of the products you mentioned, and so I want to add a few comments. First, regarding the WITS help, I liked that service a lot and used it with a lot of friends very successfully. Unfortunately, when connecting from the office to a few customers, with some of them, I had an issue that every 2 minutes or so the connection was lost and I had to re-establish. I was in contact with the developer back then, which was about a year ago, and he already had not much time anymore to work on this, but he offered me the technology for about 60,000 euro. So maybe there is still the offer available and maybe some investor wants to buy the technology. Second, regarding the Yugu, it has the option to remote control the other machine, only that the partner you connect it to has to invite you for remote control. I used that a lot with customers very successfully also, and the only problem is that lately the service, the free service, has been locked down quite drastically. And so I don't use that anymore also. So finally, I have settled with TeamViewer. So I fully understand that the TeamViewer has the most votes on the site you investigated. You wanted to see the remote cursor. And definitely there is an option in the view menu of the upper panel when you are connected to a remote machine that you can enable the remote cursor to see. Another nice feature is when you lost the connection, maybe while you are in train connecting to a remote partner, you can immediately reconnect without the need to enter the password again. And finally, there is also the support for multiple monitors. You can set as presenter in the options if you want to offer both monitors or just a single one. And even when you are the one connecting to the other machine, you can choose which monitor you want to see if the presenter offers multiple monitors. Finally, there is one issue with the TeamViewer I have struggled with a while, and I have been in contact also with the development or support team, and they haven't solved it yet. When you minimize the window and then maximize it back or restore it, then you cannot control the machine anymore. You can either then close the connection, reconnect, or just start the file transfer and immediately close the window of the file transfer, and then you get back control. This is basically the only issue, real issue I had with it. And so I like it a lot, and I use it with customers, friends, and family members, of course. And as an intensive user, I also bought a lifetime license for the major version 5. So finally, that's it. Thank you for the show, and thank you for the clear speaking.
Well, thanks, Martin. We at Going Linux like TeamViewer as well, as you know, and Tom seems to be using it all the time. And I hadn't noticed that issue with the losing control of the remote screen. But thanks for the tip. In case we do come across that, that's at least a workaround that will work. Thanks again. And thanks for the voicemail, Martin. We appreciate it. And next is a voicemail message from Steve. And Steve is the door-to-door geek. Here's his message.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Tom. Just wanted to make a quick comment about the great... By the way, this is Steve McLaughlin, door-to-door geek. I've done a good amount of research myself on like hosting your own shows, hosting your own radio shows, per se. The issue becomes bandwidth. For each person connecting to your radio station, you need to support them with all the, you know, their bandwidth. So the more people that listen, the more clogged your pipes are going to be. It becomes very hard to do. You can use third-party services like TalkShoe, Ustream, Justin TV, Live, I think it's called. So I would highly encourage to find someone else to do the actual bandwidth consumption of it, and don't try to do it yourself. Now, I know in Sweden and other countries, you have enormous bandwidth, so it might be more possible. I want to say with a typical American connection, hold like 20 to 30 people, and then your pipes become too clogged, and everybody suffers. All right, Tom. All right, Larry. Thanks again for the podcast. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Well, thanks, Steve. Those suggestions on streaming and hosting live video programs, I'm sure will be very, very helpful. And our first email is from Ron. Ron says, Hi, Ron. I'm trying to get my new fourth generation iPod to sync with G-Podder, but no luck. It does, however, see it as a camera, and I can get the pics off easily. Saves me from having to use iTunes. We'll let you know how it goes. Ron, sent from my iPod. Okay, Ron, please do let us know. G-Podder is not compatible with every iPod, but they are working to make sure that they are. Now, it's been a while since I've used an iPod or an iPhone, and I'm not sure which the fourth generation is, whether that's the brand newest one or whether that's a little ways back. But I'm sure they'll have it fixed eventually. And please do let us know, Ron. We appreciate all your feedback on this that may help other users of iPods and Linux. Our next email is from Lee. Hi, Larry and Tom. Hi, Lee. I just finished listening to episode 118, Remote Assistant Software for Linux at Work, last night. I wanted to write in and let you both know that a podcast that I help guest co-host called Linux Basics can be found at linuxbasics.com. That's linuxbasix.com. We have discussed TeamViewer and another remote software program called Mikogo, M-I-K-O-G-O. I was the one that actually wrote up a how-to using TeamViewer. In the podcast, we talked about this in episode 8. In episode 5, Mikogo was discussed. Mikogo can be found at www.mikogo.com. It is for Windows. However, it works just fine installing it into Wine. You can only remote support Windows computers. However, this is free and the license allows for commercial use. Compared to the TeamViewer, the free version is non-commercial use only. In Mikogo, how to get started is you register for free on the website with your email and a password. You start the program. An M will appear in the panel. Click on the M and choose Settings. On the first tab, type in your email and password. I check the same username and password. Then click on the Start Options tab. You can check the Use the Following Sessions ID and type one in. It is a 9-digit number. It makes it easier for the Windows user if you do this for remote support. Also, further down, under Initial Viewing Direction, click on the View and Control Others screen and click OK. Then, when you are ready to connect to the Windows user, click on the M and choose to start the session. The Windows user will need to go to join.mikogo.com and type in the session ID and then pick a username for themselves. It will then create a little executable for them to double-click on and use. If you set the session ID and not random, in the future, you would just start the session and they could open the executable and you would be accessing their computer. It will prompt the user to give permission for you to control their computer. They click yes and you have control of their computer to show or fix, etc. Thanks, Lee S. And those little bleeps you've heard during the recording, if they're actually audible, I'm not sure whether they are or not, but those are Tom desperately trying to get onto Skype, so we may have him before the end of the session after all. Let's see how it goes. Like I said, he's got some self-inflicted computer wounds here that he needs to fix before he can actually connect to us. Our next email is from Brian, who wrote, "Hi, Larry." Hi, Brian. I was wondering about this in regards to accessibility. Since Orca is a GNOME application, would it run under Unity? Also, where could I email to make my concerns known about accessibility with Orca in Ubuntu? Thanks for your great podcast, as always. And Brian provided a link to an article from Linux Magazine, I guess it is, and it's Canonical Ubuntu Splits from GNOME Over Design Issues. And the headline reads, "The next version of Canonical Ubuntu will use Unity as a desktop shell rather than the presently used GNOME." And Brian, so far, I don't see anything that indicates that Orca works on Unity. I provided Brian with a post from osdir.com, and we'll include that link in the show notes. The post is fairly typical of the information that I'm finding about Orca on Unity, and it doesn't really indicate that Orca is working at all yet. But it's early, though. There's still time for developers at Canonical to work with Orca and Unity developers to make sure that Ubuntu remains accessible to blind and low vision users using Orca and make it all work before the release of 11.04 sometime next year. Brian also shared another article, and this one's titled, "Set Gmail as the Default Email Client on Your GNOME Desktop Using GNOME Mail." This article references a tweet on Twitter that reads, "I use Thunderbird to manage all my accounts on my desktop instead of using a web interface, but most of my friends don't. They use," well, this is more than 140 characters, so this mustn't be a tweet, I wouldn't think. Anyway, "they use Gmail and are always annoyed when clicking on a mail to link opens Evolution. I'm guessing this would be the case with many of you. What if your desktop could understand that your default email client is Gmail and not a desktop-based email client? Yes, this is possible with this small but very useful application, GNOME-Gmail. GNOME-Gmail integrates the web service Gmail with your GNOME desktop. This means that you can set Gmail as your default email client, and the next time you click a mail to link or would want to send a file as email, you will be redirected to Gmail rather than Evolution or another email client. And that sounds like a very, very useful tool for those of us who use Gmail on a regular basis, and we'll include a link to the article that Brian provided in our show notes. Next up is Mike. Hey guys. Hey Mike. Heard the episode on remote assistance clients. I know remote desktop isn't exactly the same thing, but I thought I'd share anyway. Flipping through Linux format, I found this, and he provides a link, which we will of course provide in the show notes, that is 7 of the best Linux remote desktop clients. Granted, they didn't share your opinion of TeamViewer, different strokes, eh? Mike. And thanks, Mike. Our next email is from Pascal, who wrote, "Hey, Tom and Larry. Hey, Pascal. I just listened to episode 112, Listener Feedback, and I'd like to comment on the topic of purchasing a computer with Linux pre-installed. First, I'm not so sure one would want to have Linux already installed, as these installations normally are not optimal, and Linux has the advantage that you can get it installed the way you like, partitioning, encrypted disk, swap space, LVM, MBR, with dual boot, or splitting the root partition into several partitions for /var/usr, etc. By the way, there exists an EU law, European Union that is, mandating vendors to sell their computers without an OS pre-installed. As a customer, you actually have the right to demand a machine without some crappy piece of malware OS installed, and actually even pay for it. They should rather pay you for all the frustration and damage caused by it. Though if the seller plays by the rules is another question. You probably do not want to go to court on that issue. In Germany, there is a vendor that does not ship its stuff with Linux installed, but it comes without an OS at all as the default option. You can demand a Windows, though, if you like. That is Hackforce near Berlin, and he provides a link to the Hackforce website. It's www.hackforce.de. They have great, powerful, high-quality hardware, a bit pricey, though. For a decent laptop, you will have to fork out at least $1,500. The nice thing is that the hardware of their machine can be customized, so you can choose what kind of components you want, and when you call them, they tell you which stuff works best with Linux, so in most cases, you can avoid unpleasant surprises regarding hardware recognition. I like your podcast, Pascal." Well, Pascal, thanks very much. As far as Linux pre-installed on hardware and whether or not it's optimized, it really depends on where you buy your computer hardware. If you're purchasing it from... there's Tom. Let's see what he's writing on Skype chat. Okay, he's looking for a way to get his headset connected. All right, well, let's wait for him and see how that goes. In the meantime, responding back to Pascal, yes, Pascal, regarding purchasing a computer with Linux pre-installed and the possibility that these installations may not be optimized. Well, certainly a computer manufacturer pre-installing Linux doesn't know exactly how you want things set up. So to some degree, it's not optimized to your own personal taste. But it will be in most cases, depending on the computer vendor you choose, it will be optimized to the computer hardware. And so if they need to actually install some special drivers to make some proprietary hardware work, they will typically do that. Or they'll make the computer without proprietary hardware and eliminate the need for that type of proprietary driver in the first place. But if the hardware that they use does require something special, typically they'll install that, make sure it works, and provide the computer to you with everything functional. One of the pieces of hardware that is typically very difficult for an average user to get set up is a fingerprint scanner that you'll find on many laptops. And I've heard that when ordering a Dell laptop, if it comes with a fingerprint scanner, they will set it up for you with whatever distribution of Linux you've ordered it with. And that is a very good thing when a computer manufacturer will do the difficult setup for you. But if you are a bit of a geek, or you simply have your own personal preference as to how you want Linux installed on your computer, with specific partitions for specific things and certain things installed and certain things not, then ordering your computer without an operating system and installing it yourself may indeed be the way to go. And thanks, Pascal, for giving us a view of things from a European perspective, and also thanks for converting the euros into US dollars when referencing the amount of money that you need to spend at hawkforce.de. We appreciate that. Our next email is from Jeff, and Jeff asks, glad to hear the first few episodes. Are you, or have you, spoken about the Backtrack distribution? I'm extremely new to the Linux way of doing things, but I am in love with open source now. Backtrack has a lot of tools built in, and it's those tools I need to play with. I don't think it would be a practical topic for a podcast, though. The other one I've played with is Ubuntu Studio. It has some musical and video applications. Great stuff. Jeff. Well, thanks, Jeff. No, we haven't talked about the Backtrack distribution, and if it is kind of specific, perhaps it wouldn't make a good podcast episode, but we'll take a look at it and see what it's all about. And Ubuntu Studio, we haven't done a specific episode on it, but we have talked about it on several of our episodes in response to listener feedback and just in general when talking about distributions that are specifically designed for the person wanting to do audio work. So Jeff, thanks for the email and thanks for listening. The next email is from John. Hi Larry and Tom. Hi John. I'm listening at the moment to your podcast 119, and there's a guy called Joseph who just asked about using Linux to do a streaming internet radio show. I listen to a podcast called The Bugcast, which is entirely recorded and streamed live using Linux. It is presented by Dave and Caroline Lee. Today, Dave released a short show about how he produces his show, in which he mentions that he uses a tool called IDJC to mix his audio together and provide the streaming facilities. Dave is such a nice guy, I'm sure if you were to contact him, he could explain in more detail what he does. And John provides us with a couple of links, one to the Bugcast and the other is to the IDJC software on sourceforge.net. You later read an email from Ian where Tom said he didn't know what the email address was in an SSH session. It's just the username and the host name. SSH space hostname. This SSH connection will use your current username when trying to connect to the remote end. SSH space dash L, I think it's an L, not a 1, space username space hostname. This SSH connection uses the specified username when connecting to the hostname. SSH space username at hostname. Now that's the one that Tom was looking at. Again, this SSH connection uses a specified username when connecting to the hostname. All the best, and I hope you don't lose this email too. Well, John, no, we haven't lost your email, and thanks for the feedback on this. Okay, looking over at Skype chat, still no word back from Tom.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
Welcome back, Tom.
It's late, but at least
hey, that's okay. We got started, and I've read a few of the emails. We've got a few more to go, and before we go on, what went wrong? My goodness.
Oh, Lord. I was, let's see, I was reading the LXer yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And some guy wrote an article about Epiphany, and he had tried it out in his distribution, which was not Ubuntu, by the way.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I'll go look at Enlightenment, and then I'll be able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I installed something called, I think it was E16.
Okay.
Logged out. Said instead of GNOME, I selected the E16 GNOME. Came back, and everything was completely broken.
Ouch!
So,
and when you say completely broken,
I had no Windows Manager.
No Windows Manager
at all.
So you had a terminal, and that was it?
No, I had my desktop, but if I would open anything, I couldn't move it or maximize it or minimize it, and it didn't show up in the bottom panel. And it was entirely useless.
Wow.
And I couldn't put it back. So I upgraded to 10.04.
Okay. And that worked?
It seems to be working.
Okay.
Not real fond of the black on gray colors, but I can change that.
Yes, you can, very easily. And you can make it look like Fedora if you go use one of the standard themes, like ClearLooks or something. But well, I'm glad things are working again. So it was simply an upgrade from your existing installation. You didn't have to do a fresh install. The upgrade worked.
Oh, no, it was a fresh install.
Oh, okay.
I tried upgrading, and about halfway through the upgrade, it told me something. It said, you know, blah, 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 and then click continue. Well, I had lost my keyboard and my mouse, so I couldn't click anything, so it was start over.
Oh, yeah.
I know, it's a sad story.
Well, I'm glad things appear to be working, well, at least well enough to record this. And if we're not recording this, then I'll go back and record the last part of this myself.
Okay.
But let's proceed assuming that everything is working just fine.
Let's do that. And where are you?
Okay, we are just about to read an email from Bill. Why don't you read the email and I'll read my response.
Okay. Bill wrote, I love your show and learn so much from each episode. I have a laptop running OpenSUSE 11.2. It runs Squeezebox server for my music collection. Is it possible to convert the laptop to Ubuntu 10.04 and keep the music? The music is on a separate partition. Or should I back up all the music to an external hard drive, install, and then copy back? I already have a backup of the music. Hoping to do this install from a flash drive using UNetBootin. Oh. Thank you for your great program, Bill.
And I wrote back to Bill and said, Bill, yes, you can move from OpenSUSE to Ubuntu on your laptop, and you should be able to do it from your flash drive. Since Novell's distribution uses a separate home partition by default, I'm assuming that you will want to keep that configuration. Ubuntu uses a single partition if you choose to use all of the defaults when installing. Though rare, since any installation of a new operating system can go horribly wrong, please make use of that external backup copy, just in case. When you start the Ubuntu installer, choose the option that lets you create your own partitions manually, and then follow a good tutorial. And we'll include a link in our show notes to a post that shows screenshots of the graphical installer and manual partitioning, but it does not go into how to preserve an existing home partition. Note, if you follow this particular tutorial, you will definitely need that external backup. Your existing home partition will be replaced with a new empty one. And we'll provide a link to an additional post that talks about converting from OpenSUSE to Ubuntu, and it does it in a way that might actually be more helpful. Once you have your Ubuntu up and running, you will need to decide whether or not you want to install Squeezebox, not available in the Ubuntu Software Center, or use another music player. Rhythmbox is installed by default, but there are plenty of others available, and of course, you can get Squeezebox from the website and install the Debian/Ubuntu package. Remember that you are now using .deb, not .rpm packages. And that was my response to Bill.
Sounds like good advice. And you know what we've been telling people about storing the names of your programs with dpkg
yes.
into a file and then getting them back?
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful advice, but it didn't work for me.
Oh, well, I've tried it and it did work.
Yeah, I probably have to try again. I've been frantically getting this thing going again.
Yeah, it's possible that, you know, one character in the wrong place could have messed things up. So,
And let me clarify. I say I've been frantically getting this thing going. It ran perfectly right away out of the box. It's just getting everything back the way I like it again and getting my programs.
Right. And trying to get Skype set up so that we can record this session, which I appreciate you doing.
Well, it isn't set up yet. I kind of cobbled it together. So
yeah, well, that's the nature of having a disaster. It's the aftermath. So.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go on with Bill here. I see he wrote back.
Yep, he did.
And Bill said, thanks for your reply. I'm replying to you from the Acer laptop I recently upgraded to Ubuntu 10.04. I'm having so much fun with Ubuntu. I made sure not to use the two partitions that had music and went ahead with the Ubuntu install from a 1 gig flash drive. What a breeze. The two partitions that I preserved magically appeared on my desktop with all my music and podcasts, including Going Linux, of course. I added the Slim Server repository, then downloaded and installed the Squeezebox package. It is currently scanning the song folder and building the library. One question. The two partitions appear on the desktop as 67 gigabyte file system and 64 gigabyte file system. Is there any way to rename these to, say, Music 1 and Music 2? Also, can I rename a directory in Linux? This is a very satisfying experience for me, and I sincerely appreciate your help. Bill.
Well, Bill, yes, yes, yes. You can.
And yes, yes.
Yeah, yes, and yes again. You can rename those partitions, and you can rename any folder you like, pretty much, anyway, unless it's a system folder, which you could probably rename, but you don't want to.
No.
Yeah. And we're very happy that we were able to make that switch so easily. It should be really easy to change the label of any mounted partition. There are several ways to do it, but with Ubuntu, you can do it without downloading any special packages or any utilities or anything, and without using the command line. First, step one, launch the Disk Utility program, and you'll find that under the System menu in Administration and then System Utility. In the list of storage devices on the left, select the first music partition. On the right, scroll down to the Volumes section and click on Unmount Volume. Next, click on Edit File System Label, and then edit the label, giving it whatever name you like, and then click the Apply button. Click on Mount Volume. And, of course, repeat that process with the other partition. So now you've got your partitions renamed. To rename a folder or a directory within a partition, simply right-click on the folder and choose Properties. You'll see right away where to rename it. And a quicker way is to select the folder and then press F2 on your keyboard. It will give you a chance to rename it right there on the screen in the file browser that you're using. So, Bill, good luck with your Acer laptop, with your new installation of Ubuntu 10.04, and your two music partitions. Sounds like you got a lot of stuff there.
Next up, we've got Travis. Travis says, "Hey, Tom and Larry. Hey, Travis.
Hey, Travis.
I really enjoy your podcast. However, I haven't listened for a while because I went on vacation. Anyway, I just finished the listener feedback episode 166, where one of your listeners mentioned that he had just bought a new HP compact laptop that had the regular F keys disabled, and you have to press the function key to make them work like function keys. That's the FN key. Well, my wife has a similar model, and I understand this frustration. However, there is a way to disable the action keys and make them act like regular F keys. It's found in the BIOS setup. If I recall correctly, your caller was visually impaired, so I hope that he's able to work in the BIOS without any problem. But I thought that I would share the solution. Sorry that I don't have any more specific instructions, but I hope that this helps. Regards, Travis."
And Travis, yes, I have one of those computers with that same sort of situation. And if you recall, way back then, I was having some issues with getting into the BIOS because I had blown away the recovery partition where the BIOS password was. Right? So I finally found some stuff to unlock the BIOS and was able to get in there. And in fact, did find that location. It's pretty easy to find where you disable the special function key functions. And just by way of explanation, normally when you press the F4 key or the Alt F4, it will close a window for you, for example.
Sure.
Well, on the laptop that I have, the F4 key is a key that goes into the properties for the display so that you will switch to, you know, an external monitor or something like that.
Okay.
Well, unlike every other computer on the market, HP has decided that, oh, it would be nice to have, you know, that special function of a display, or brighten or dim the screen, or play media, or increase or decrease the volumes, which are normally the shifted, using the FN key, shifted function for the function key. Well, they've made that the default. And then if you want to actually press F1 for help or F2 to edit a file name, you actually have to hold down the function, the FN key. Yeah, so they've reversed everything. But the good news is they've allowed you to switch that over in the BIOS. So I did that as well, and it works just fine.
Thanks, Travis.
Yes, thanks. Thanks very much. Okay, my turn. Let's read this one from Charles. Charles wrote, "Hi, Larry and Tom."
Hi, Charles. Charles.
"I had a, quote, interesting experience in my attempt to upgrade to Maverick on Racing Cow." And you remember, Charles has named his computers, and his Gateway desktop from 2001 is named Racing Cow.
Okay.
"For several reasons, I am running with Wubi. After backing up my data, I decided to try the version upgrade instead of a fresh install. It all went swimmingly until it was time to reboot to finish the process." That's usually when it all fails, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah. Yeah.
"I missed the opportunity to choose Ubuntu on the reboot because of the knock at the door, and I rebooted a second time, and the next thing I saw was a grub prompt. Oops. In my actual life, I went back to that other OS, uninstalled the Wubi partition, and did the fresh install, so I am back in business. What might I have done in my ideal life, the one in which I always know what to do? Also, Racing Cow wants to know about this Unity thing that is supposed to replace the GNOME desktop in Ubuntu 11.04. I think she's afraid of being, quote, sent to the farm if she doesn't have the horsepower to run it. I've given assurances that we could put GNOME back or even switch to Zubuntu if power becomes an issue. And there are other distributions out there for the same price as well. I think Racing Cow would rather hear these comments confirmed by someone other than just me. After all, you are both too far away to help take her off to the farm." Thanks. Charles from New Jersey.
Well, Charles, a lot of people are getting their undies in a knot over that one, and I'm not going to worry about it.
Yeah, at least until next year.
Yeah, I trust Ubuntu. and I'm sure that when they first roll it out, it's going to be a little glitchy, and there's going to be a lot of whining and complaints from me.
And others, yes.
Right, but they'll iron it out. It's Ubuntu.
Yeah, exactly. And from what I've been reading recently, they're going to offer the classic Ubuntu interface as an option.
Okay.
Or at least I hope they continue to think along those lines. But I did respond back to Charles and to Racing Cow. Don't worry about being able to run Unity. Unity is what they use on the most recent netbook editions of Ubuntu. I can only imagine that one of the reasons Ubuntu is switching to a Unity on the desktop is to improve performance. If that is true, Unity should run faster than GNOME. Whether Unity works for you or not, I'm sure GNOME will be available in the repositories. The question is, will it be the new GNOME 3 or the old familiar GNOME 2? I'm wondering which I will like better, GNOME 3 or Unity. This will be interesting.
And another nice thing is, seeing as how it's Linux, you're not locked in.
Yeah.
There are so many things you can set up the way you want.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you want to read Charles's response to my response to his response?
Oh, sure. Okay. Charles responded, saying, "Thanks, Larry. I ended up putting Lucid back on Racing Cow, applying the 150 updates, and trying the Maverick upgrade again. As far as I can tell from forum posts, there is a known issue with Grub in the Maverick upgrade for Wubi installations. There was a hostile tone in some posts that decried the use of Wubi for purposes other than test drives and demos, but I ignore those comments. My off-label use of Wubi has been relatively trouble-free, so I knew that my original upgrade problem would be fixed in time. If there was an actual problem, it has apparently been fixed. I tried the whole process again, and everything worked perfectly. A Wubi installer for Maverick would be nice, but this is fine for now. Hint, do backups before you start an OS upgrade on any platform. It will improve your well-being and promote world peace." Well, maybe not the world peace part, but you get the idea. "These Wubi blips will, of course, become a non-issue once Racing Cow is fully defenestrated. Cheers." true. And also, if you're at the Wubi page, there are some disclaimers.
Yes, there are.
There are some releases of Ubuntu that they tell you out and out, do not try to upgrade. You have to do a full install. So you have to pay attention to those things.
Yep. And our next email is from Ray. Ray writes, "Hi, Larry and Tom."
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Ray. "Could you please point me to a guide, or could you explain how to install a tar.gz? As good as Linux Mint is, there is still a need on occasion to go outside the package manager. I can muck my way through some installs, but getting a launch icon on the desktop can be very hit or miss. When I look for help for this, I get the usual assumed knowledge that I do not have. There are always instructions like this: /configure --make --install. Unfortunately, my terminal knowledge is limited to sudo apt-get install. My Mint has spoiled me. Thanks for your great podcast, Ray."
And you wrote back to him. Shall I read what you wrote?
Go right ahead, sir.
I shall. Larry wrote, "Think of a tar.gz file as a compressed file. Under Windows, most compressed files end in .zip. Under Linux, there are other formats of compressed files that end in extensions like .zip or .tar or .gz or .rar or .tar.gz. The good news is that with Ubuntu and Mint, the program that handles these files, FileRoller, can recognize and handle all of these formats. With Linux, when software is provided in a .tar.gz file, you're dealing with source code and not a precompiled deb package. The instructions you mentioned are the commands you type into the command line to compile and install the software. You will want to follow them very carefully, doing exactly what they say in exactly the order you say them. Just like working with a .zip file under Windows, you need to extract all of the files before you can work with them. Unless the instructions say to do something else, I usually create a folder in my home directory and extract all the files to that. Once you've done that, open a terminal and get into the folder you created. You'll need to use the CD, that is, change directory command, to do that. For example, if the folder you created is named installation, then you would open a terminal and type CD space installation. Now follow the instructions provided for compiling and installing the software. Remember that when a command in instructions begins with a dollar sign, it means that you can run that command as a normal user. When the command begins with a pound sign, it means that you must be root to run the command. With Ubuntu or Mint, that means that whenever you see a line like pound space make space install, you actually need to type sudo space make space install. There are other ways to run these commands as root, but this is the safest. Also note, when installing software from source code like this, Ubuntu or Mint will do its best to find any dependencies, but remember, the package has not likely been built specifically for Ubuntu and may not work quite right.
And so, Ray, I am really hoping that helped you out. I know you're a user who spends most of the time in the graphical user interface, and installing applications from source code can be a little scary, but if you follow the instructions, you should be okay.
And by instructions, we mean once you've extracted those files from the archive, look around at the files, and one of them might say README or instructions or something on that order.
Right, exactly. And if you don't find them there, and you should find them there, that's the standard way of providing you those instructions. But they may also be on the website where you got the source code in the first place. They may have actually retyped those or copied and pasted those into the web page, so you can follow it from the web page as well if you like. So good luck.
Okay, our next is from Jamil. And Jamil says, "Hi there, I am Jamil."
Hi there, Jamil.
I am 15-year-old and have been using computers since I was about 5 years old. Up until last year, all I knew there was, as far as operating systems, was Mac OS and Windows. I hadn't heard about Linux. When I learned about it last year, I also found out about your podcast and listened to them. I used Linux Ubuntu every once in a while, here and there, but now I use it on a regular basis and love it, in caps. I am currently running the latest Ubuntu 10.10 Maverick Meerkat, or whatever they call it. I never ran into a problem with it until now.
Dun, dun, dun.
I keep getting this error about the Ubuntu Software Center. Requires installation of untrusted packages. It will not allow me to install anything. Do you know why this is happening? Anyways, I haven't totally been keeping up with your podcast, so I don't know if you've mentioned this problem yet. I got another question. What is Ubuntu Server? I got several PowerEdge servers and am interested in using Ubuntu Server, but I don't know Ubuntu code, and I heard there's no desktop in Ubuntu Server. So what's the deal with that? Thanks for your help, Jamil.
Okay, Jamil, it's great to read that you're enjoying Ubuntu Linux, and I think we can help you with your two questions. Regarding the error message, you likely already know that the Software Center is installing packages from locations on the internet called repositories. It's most likely that you've added one of these repositories manually to the, quote, sources list, or to the list of repositories. The sources list is a text file, and its name is sources.list. That contains the various locations the package manager, which is the software behind the Software Center, uses to find the software that you can install. I'm going to include a link in our show notes to a post in the Ubuntu forums. By the way, I encourage you to use the forums to find this kind of help from very experienced Ubuntu users anytime, night or day. The post is from body.zazen. The third one from the top in that list provides a link to some documentation on the Ubuntu website that describes GPG keys. Read through the forum posts in this thread to see the issues from other Ubuntu users, then check out Body Sazen's link. Read through that and make sure you have the GPG keys for all of the package sources in your package repository. Regarding the Ubuntu server issue, in general, whether a server is running Ubuntu, Windows, or some other operating system, it's much like any regular computer, except that it has a very special purpose. The purpose of a server is to manage a computer network, host one or more websites, provide a file repository for a network of computers, transfer email from location to location, etc. It's the kind of computer that only an administrator logs into directly, and the administrator usually logs into it remotely using some remote control software. Since the administrator usually only logs into a server to perform security patches, fix a problem, or check that some bad guy hasn't hacked into the server, they don't really need a graphical user interface. In fact, many servers don't have a monitor, keyboard, or mouse. Most server administrators can do everything they need to do from the command line, so they just log into the server from their own local computer, then use a terminal to do their work. They run the commands they need to run to perform the tasks they need to perform, then log out. Ubuntu Server is a version of Ubuntu that is designed to be installed as the operating system on these kinds of servers. So it doesn't need a graphical desktop or programs that run in a graphical window. In fact, Ubuntu Server Edition is specifically designed for users on servers and comes pre-installed with a lot of command line utilities that only server administrators would need. So hopefully that'll help you out, Jamil.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have Aegon Linux story.
Yes.
Yay, from Scott. And Scott writes, "Hey, Larry."
Hey, Scott. Sorry, Tom.
I wrote in a while back about my netbook's connectivity problems, and another listener responded later saying that the Wi-Fi card in his netbook was overheating, and he fixed the problem by replacing it. That would be $15 well spent in my book, but as it happens, the problem went away when I upgraded to Maverick. They must have applied a fix of some sort somewhere between the beta and the final release. I love when my operating system continues to improve with subsequent updates instead of slowing down like another operating system I used to use. Also, you can tell Tom that I don't think he needs to worry about having problems with Skype on his update. I noticed that it's in the Ubuntu Software Center. The primary reason I bring this up is that you neglected to mention its screen sharing functionality in your previous episode. Like a lot of others, you can't really control another's computer with it, but I can talk to my friend on Skype. He's running OS X and I'm running Ubuntu, and we can show each other's screens to one another. I find it convenient for casual usage, especially since it's software that a lot of people already have. I might have one more suggestion, as long as I'm writing to you. Whenever you go on Computer America, I know the hosts mention that Linux doesn't really work for them because of their jobs, which mainly consist of repairing Windows machines. I personally find Linux to be a perfect tool with the live boot CDs, partitioning utilities, and anti-malware tools such as ClamAV. Obviously, professionals such as the show's hosts will have their own established and efficient methods of working within Windows to fix problems that arise. But why not do a general show on fixing Windows with Linux anyways? That's an idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, yeah, We could do a show on using Linux to fix Windows, but I don't know. I don't have a Windows machine around that I could use it on. What? Perhaps we can reference somebody else who does that. I don't know who that is. I don't travel in many circles where we have Windows problems that people use Linux to fix.
Yeah. I can see that, though.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, there are plenty of tools. And when I was switching back and forth between Linux and Windows, I would often use a Linux Live CD to fix things, or some utilities that ran from a CD based on Linux, like, well, some of the ones that Scott has mentioned here. Yeah, ClamAV or Gparted and software like that. It's great. But I don't do that too much at all.
And as far as Skype is concerned, Scott, this is a fresh install. It's been running for tens of minutes. And when I go into Skype options, audio options, and let's see, I'll look at it right now. Yeah. And I go into sound devices, my only choice is Pulse Audio Server Local. And I want to be able to switch it over and use my headset. Now, I am using my headset right now, but I had to go in to, I'll look at that, sound options, sound preferences, and select the headset for everything.
Now, that's sound options in Linux, not in Skype, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Sound preferences, yeah.
Yeah.
So I want it to automatically, I want Skype to use my headset, and I want everything else to use the internal audio analog stereo.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll figure it out.
Yeah, now I have mine set up, Tom, so that Skype is using the headset, which we're using right now.
How did you do that?
Well, just the way you did, where I told Skype, use Pulse Audio and go ahead and use the headset using the Linux sound preferences tool. But then I have a USB mixer that I'm recording this through Audacity on. And as a result, it's a separate interface altogether. So I can easily say, Audacity, go use the digital input from USB, and Skype, go use the analog input. And it remembers that. The only thing that is rather annoying is if I reboot my computer, it will mute the analog input for Skype, and I have to go in and remember to unmute it. But as long as I remember to do that, everything works just fine, and it remembers the settings. And our last Gone Linux email is from Bill. Bill writes, "Hi, Larry and Tom."
Hiya, Bill.
Hi, Bill. "I am glad you found the link to Ubuntu 10.04 Extras helpful. As you mentioned in your listener feedback podcast, the blog site is quite a list of extras. Thanks to you, I now have a great way to remotely access my newly rebuilt Ubuntu Squeezebox laptop, which used to have OpenSUSE. Setup was a breeze, and I tested from my machine at work. Excellent. I have 5 computers here at home. Am I allowed to install the Team Viewer on each one, or do I need to connect to one, then VNC to any of the others? Either way, this will make it very easy to control the home network from anywhere. Best regards, Bill." And as our Team Viewer expert, Tom, between the two of us anyway.
Hey, yeah, you can... you can install it on as many of your computers as you like. No problems there. And you can set up a permanent password to get into that anytime TeamViewer is running. Now, you've got an ID number and a password. That ID number is always going to stay the same for that machine. So if you write down the ID numbers of your different machines and set up passwords for each of them, you can remotely get into any computer from any computer that you own, and that's set up.
Yeah, I'm thinking his question may also be, can I connect to one computer from more than one other computer simultaneously?
If you put the computer into presentation mode, that you want to have multiple computers seeing that one, yes.
But you couldn't control one computer from two computers at the same time. That really is something I wouldn't want to do myself anyway. What I'm thinking is perhaps he has a computer at work and a computer at home that he wants to use to manage this computer with TeamViewer on it, and he may leave it connected at work and then try to connect from his computer at home and not...
I don't know what would happen if you tried it with multiple computers. Let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. Give it a try. See what happens. What could possibly go wrong? Take a lesson from Tom. Back up first.
Yes.
Back up first.
I had just made a backup, too, in anticipation. Oh. I was about to upgrade anyway, so I had made a backup. So I'm golden. Just have to put my programs back.
That is good. And for a software pick, I don't have one, and I bet yours is reinstallation software.
Mine is, I don't know. I got a million things in the air right now, and I'm just happy it's running at all.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, on our next episode, we will have Computer America number 33. And for those of you who have applauded my more aggressive editing of these episodes to remove everything except the good stuff. I appreciate that. And I'm doing it for you because I've had a lot of requests to do that.
What, no movie reviews?
No movie reviews, no people getting prizes of Windows-only software and that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. I've taken a real hatchet to this. And, you know, a two-hour show gets edited down to about an hour's worth of real content. So.
Sure.
Anyway, until that episode, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations.
And please email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. Podcast alley voting seems to be broken right now. It was last month, and it is this month again.
Yeah, so hopefully they'll get that fixed. I was expecting that that would be a problem only for a month, but and I have sent in a notice to the person who manages it and have not received any response back. That's not a good sign.
Shall we unleash the minions?
Maybe we shall. So, minions, if you can figure out where to send the email on Podcast Alley, go ahead and say, hey, it's broken. I can't vote. My vote's not being registered. Yeah, you can vote. You go in and vote, and normally what it does is it sends you an email and says, please confirm that you're a real person, and you never receive the email. So we never receive the votes. So nobody's receiving votes, because if you go on Podcast Alley, you'll see, if you look at the technology category, there aren't any votes for any of those. So it's really strange. It's
broken.
Very seriously broken, yeah.
I think we should send Jimmy Carter in to monitor the voting system.
All right, let's do that.
Okay.
In the meantime, you can send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. You can send that email to goinglinux@gmail.com, or you can use our voicemail line. The number is +1-904-468-7889.
Which is also 1-904-4-OUR-TUX.
Yes.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux. You can download the episodes from our website, or you can use the Flash Player to play them right on the show notes page.
Oh, and we have also started experimenting with HTML5. So there's a little HTML5 player there as well. So ooh, try that out. Yeah, maybe we can get rid of Flash.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. Yeah. You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as the new episodes are available. For instructions on how to subscribe to ours or any other podcast, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com for instructions. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco,
at podcastthemes.com.